court is now ready to hear argument in In Re James Allen Hall 070322.
The court, Mr. Patton will present argument for the relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This proceeding presents an issue of first impression. Does a juvenile offender who's been prosecuted, adjudicated, and sentenced under the Juvenile Justice Code have a statutory right under the code to appointed habeas counsel?
Do you agree that an adult would not have a right to appointed counsel in these circumstances?
Absolutely. We are not claiming that there is a statutory constitutional right apart from the Juvenile Justice Code. Our position is that the trial court had a mandatory obligation to appoint habeas counsel for Mr. Hall, and basically we have three arguments. I'll very briefly state them before going over them in detail on why the trial court had this mandatory obligation. First, Mr. Hall and every other juvenile offender has a mandatory, not optional, not permissive right to appointed habeas counsel.
Well, but it says habeas proceedings challenging the legality of detention resulting from action under this title. And the argument's been made that detention is pre-adjudication and post-adjudication commitment does not fit that definition.
That's one of their arguments. Their first argument is no how, no way. There's no right at any time. The second argument is if there's a right, it exists only to the pre-adjudication stage. The third argument is that if it exists pre-adjudication and post-adjudication, that right disappears at age 18. I'm happy to talk about the second point first.
I'm curious to know, if detention is different from commitment under the Juvenile Justice Code, then why would that argument not be correct?
I think you've hit on what is actually the closest issue in the case, the pre versus post-adjudication issue. The way they frame it is there's no right to post-adjudication, post-disposition, post-determinate sentence, post-transfer to the Texas Department of Corrections. And there's nothing in the statute that refers to that. They're absolutely right. There is no restriction like that in the statute. If the legislature had wanted to limit the right to pre-adjudication, it could have easily inserted pre-adjudication, the word pre-adjudication, in front of detention, and it did not. It could have defined detention, which it did not. It could have put in a cutoff in the right to counsel section about when the right to counsel is cut off, and it did not. What they have said in their brief is that detention is a term of art. Well, it's a term of art that's not defined in the Juvenile Justice Code. It's not defined in the Code of Criminal Procedure, and it's not defined in the Penal Code. And customarily, when this court is faced with a term that is not defined in a statute, it looks to the common everyday meanings, and I think one of the references cited in my brief is Black's Law Dictionary, which refers to detention as being equivalent to a confinement. My client's certainly been confined. He's been confined since he was basically 13 years old. So I think in the context of the right to counsel provision, the court can read detention as equivalent to confinement.
So what is that? Why doesn't that right, if it exists, cease when he turns 18? And why is this even important?
That's their third argument, which is if the right exists, then there's a cutoff at age 18. The state's argument that the starting and ending point for any analysis of the Mr. Hall's right to counsel entirely focuses on his age, I think it's contrary to the code when you look at the statute in its entirety, and it would be a constitutionally impermissible construction. Under the code, his right to counsel attached when he was prosecuted as a child, and that's clear from the jurisdictional statement in the code at section 51.04. The jurisdictional statement provides that this title, Juvenile Justice Code, applies to all cases involving delinquent conduct committed by a person who was a child at the time they engaged in the conduct. The focus of the code is on when the conduct was committed. It's not, the focus is not on when a request was made. So his right attached at the time he was prosecuted under the code.
And it ends when he no longer is a child, correct?
No, it does not.
I mean, yeah, why not? I don't understand why.
Because
he's an adult now. Comes under a different classification.
Not under the Juvenile Justice Code. The best example of that is the leading habeas corpus decision involving juvenile delinquency proceedings discussed in my brief, Ex Parte Valle. In that case, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that a juvenile offender who is adjudicated under the code and who is now an adult, his habeas action, he is not treated as an adult offender. He's treated as a juvenile offender, and he's still subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the juvenile court.
Even and when he's 60?
Yeah, well, I think the answer to that is yes, according to Ex Parte Valle.
That just seems to make no sense.
I think that was the argument that lost in Ex Parte Valle.
Well, you know, you may lose if you don't explain why it makes sense.
Well, again, the Juvenile Justice Code creates a hybrid system between treating offenders as juveniles and treating them as adult offenders. And because of that, a juvenile court retains jurisdiction over the offender even after that juvenile becomes an adult. For, again, it's the habeas example. In Ex Parte Valle, the offender went to the Court of Criminal Appeals and said, I have a right under Code of Criminal Procedure 11.07 to have my habeas action heard in a criminal court and appealed to your court. The Court of Criminal Appeals said, no, we know you're an adult, but this is still a juvenile proceeding, even though you are an adult, and the juvenile court has exclusive jurisdiction over it due to the jurisdictional statement in the code. The juvenile court has continuing jurisdiction. So the rights that attach while one is a juvenile continue into an adulthood. It's important to recognize that in some areas, the legislature put in explicit age cutoffs on rights. They didn't do it on the right to counsel. And another aspect of the code I think is important is that the code essentially provides that the right to counsel continues until the case is terminated. The code doesn't define what is meant by the case is terminated. Ex Parte Valle indicates that the juvenile case has not terminated at the habeas filing level because, according to Valle, the juvenile court still has jurisdiction whether the juvenile offender is 27, 37, or, as Justice Brister said, 60. Aspect of the code is I think that the code at least implicitly recognized that the right to counsel would continue beyond age 18 when it required the mandatory appointment of appellate counsel for indigents. I think this court can recognize that it wouldn't be at all uncommon how long it takes a case to wind through the appellate process for someone to have their appeal start at 16, receive appointed counsel, and have the appeal not decided until after they were 18. Under the state's position, they'd lose their right to appointed counsel at mid-appeal. I mean, for example, if I were qualified to handle an adjudication disposition appeal, which I'm most definitely not, and I were appointed, under the state's position, where there's an automatic absolute age cutoff at 18, the day before I'm supposed to argue this case in the Court of Appeals, my client turns 18, they lose their attorney. And that's not how the statute's written.
Could it be written that way?
Constitutionally? I think they could have put in an age cutoff in there. I don't think they could cut off the right to counsel in mid-appeal, but could they have put some form of an age limit in there? They probably could have, but they did not.
You believe the date is pegged to when the crime was committed and not when the conviction took place?
I think under Section 51.04, the juvenile offender's rights attach when he is prosecuted for conduct occurring while he was a child. So it would be the date the conduct occurs.
So if the crime occurs when he's 17, but he's arrested and prosecuted and convicted when he's 18, you'd be arguing the same thing you are today.
That's a little different because there are provisions of the code that are specifically tied to when somebody during the course of a prosecution goes from 17 to 18. So that's a different situation.
Okay.
And I'm concerned about someone who might abuse the system. We, of course, like most appellate courts, get lots of handwritten stuff from prisoners who don't have anything better to do with their time. Does this create a situation where someone could abuse the system by filing habeas every year and having to appoint a counsel and do all this stuff? Is that just a problem that's the legislature's problem, not our problem, or is that something we can take into account?
I think if the only way, because not in the record, the only way you can look at this is the amount of juvenile habeases that you see in reported cases, and there are actually very few. And I think that's a product of the fact that nobody knows how to do them, because unlike 1107 habeases for an adult offender, there are no forms, there are no rules, there's nothing. Nobody knows how to do them.
If there are very few, why is this so important?
It's important to Mr. Hall, and it will have an effect, I assume, on other people in his position. It may not be many people, but it is a right that he has. Well, I can't answer it any better than that.
There's going to be a lot more if we say that they do have that right, wouldn't you?
I agree with that.
Then they have perhaps people like Mr. Higgins at the Seventh Court that we've had a couple of decisions on.
Yes.
That could help people like him in the juvenile context, with similar people, the courthouse, jailhouse lawyers, and say, okay, this is what you can do now, and I'll help you. You kind of stimulate a lot more activity, wouldn't you think?
I think it will stimulate some activity. I don't think it will stimulate repetitive habeas filings by the same person, because if they import certain aspects of 1100C Code of Criminal Procedure habeas filings, you only get one shot. You only have one shot at a habeas. You can't file repeated habeas applications unless there's a change in the law. So you don't have the situation which y'all see of just repeated filings over and over by the same person involving the same stuff. I don't think you get that.
So if appointed counsel stays with the case, it's your position that that would mean any habeas arising out of that prosecution or anything else? Am I right? Am I missing something here?
Well, that's a very good question. The way the statute is written, it talks about each juvenile board has to create a list of counsel who are suitable for appointments to cases and the level of the case at which they are qualified. And if you're appointed to do the trial work and you're not competent to do the appeal, then you can essentially ask to withdraw, and that's, as a practical matter, what happens. There are very, very few people, as I understand it, who can do habeas work. So I think the reality of the situation is people would withdraw at different levels, and then the trial court, when they got an application for appointment to habeas counsel, would have to go to the list of qualified attorneys for that particular county and decide who on that list is qualified to handle it. But I don't think, for example, I think going to your question, you get appointed at the detention hearing, you're the attorney for the man through trial, appeal, and habeas for years. I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to leave the rest of my argument for rebuttal unless the court has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Patton.
Thanks.
Court is now ready to hear argument from the District Attorney's Office.
Mr. Geary will present argument for the real party and interest.
Please, Court, I'm honored to be here today on behalf of the state in this case. It's, I think, an interesting case, one where this court can take advantage of the opportunity to catch up with both the United States Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals on the topic of whether indigent criminals are entitled to appointment of counsel to assist them with the writ of habeas corpus. As I think Mr. Patton conceded, there is no right to appointed counsel to assist with habeas in the criminal context, in a purely criminal context. And
what did the U.S. Supreme Court recently decide to these terrorists down there in Guantanamo? They have some type of rights or some...
Right. Well, you know, I honestly, I did not look at that opinion preparing for this argument today, but I will tell you what I believe. If I recall, I've seen that opinion, and I believe what they decided was that, some of them had a right to the pursuit of habeas corpus, but not necessarily a right to appointment of counsel, at least not a constitutional right. I can tell you that the Supreme Court of the United States has spoken on this topic in capital cases and has said that in capital cases, that is those where the death penalty is the sentence that's imposed, that there is a right to the appointment of counsel to assist with the initial habeas application. But that is a statutory right, not one that is gleaned from the Constitution, such as the right to assistance of counsel at trial and during the first appeal of right.
So if the U.S. Supreme Court thinks it's okay for these people that are trying to harm us to have some type of rights, so why isn't it okay for an American citizen to have this little right here? What's the harm in that?
Well, I understand what your point is, and I think that what I would say to that is the state of Texas in no way is arguing today that Mr. Hall is not entitled to pursue the writ of habeas corpus. The writ of habeas corpus is certainly available to him, certainly through the Constitution. I think you would go to Article 5, Section 8 of the Constitution to find the avenue through which he would be able to avail himself to the writ, not 1107, because it's not a technically criminal case, as the Court of Criminal Appeals has said. It's a juvenile case. So he would file that writ with the trial court, and the trial court would then be capable of acting on that writ of habeas corpus. But the question before us today is not whether he can pursue the writ of habeas corpus, but whether or not the state is required to afford him the benefit of free counsel to assist him in the pursuit of that action. And the state's position is that it certainly does not have to afford free counsel under these situations.
What would guide a court's discretion if the statute says counsel may be appointed? I mean, what's a trial court to do with that? You're an indigent child. Well, I feel like appointing you one today or not. I mean, it seems to me like we've said before, sometimes may means must, and sometimes must means may. Why would you not afford an indigent child the right to counsel?
Well, first of all, let me see if I can answer your question by explaining what would happen ordinarily in an adult case where a defendant filed a writ of habeas corpus and asked for the assistance of counsel. The courts have said to those particular types of claimants that they're not entitled as a matter of right to have counsel appointed to assist them with that type of claim. I think if you go back to Fay v. Noya, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court clarified that these are really civil types of actions that are collateral attacks on the criminal judgment that's already final. What happens is when they submit, as a practical matter, application for writ of habeas corpus that makes a claim that a trial court or the Court of Criminal Appeals in some instances finds to be, say, not frivolous, then the courts are at liberty. They have the discretion to appoint counsel to assist people under those circumstances. But again, a discretion to appoint counsel is certainly not the same thing as a mandatory duty to appoint counsel. And I think if you look at the facts of this case, what you see is a request for the appointment of counsel that was filed by Mr. Hall, absent any application for writ of habeas corpus along with it, to identify what it is he even thinks he would like to argue about. He's simply barely, just plainly asking for, I want a lawyer to help me to figure out what I should complain about.
How's this different from ex parte vae?
Well, ex parte vae is a case where the court said that these types of habeas applications are still under the juvenile type of system, and so that the claims need to come to the Supreme Court, not to the Court of Criminal Appeals. But this, again, is not an application for writ of habeas corpus. This claim decidedly is a claim for the appointment of counsel to assist with the preparation of that application, which is an entirely different thing.
So when does that right, if it exists, end? When Vice says it doesn't, even until you go to 60 or 50 or whatever the age is? Like I said, that makes no sense to me. If you're a child up to the age 18, then become something else at 18 in one day.
Right. Well, I think the right to the assistance of counsel under the juvenile code continues until the proceedings against the child are terminated. The proceedings, I think, involve the trial that he's entitled to, certainly the first appeal of right that he is entitled to. And the code, the juvenile code supports that. And I think Mr. Patton raised an issue that might seem like something that might be difficult for you to get over, which is what happens if he turns 18 in the middle of his appeal. Under the juvenile code, the juvenile court would still have jurisdiction over that case, and so would the Court of Appeals, to remand that case to the juvenile court to deal with that. And that would be under Section 51.041B. So the proceedings, if I'm understanding you, Justice Medina, are going to be those proceedings that go all the way through the trial and the first appeal of right. And once that's done, he certainly has a right to pursue other remedies, such as a discretionary review in this court, but not a right to appointed counsel to assist him in those proceedings. Basically, our argument, I think, comes down to, and I think it's poignant to notice that Mr. Patton has limited his argument to the existence of a statutory right, not a constitutional right. And so we would say that there are three reasons why there is no statutory right here. The first one is that this defendant, Mr. Hall, is certainly not a child. And the provisions, I think, contrary to what Mr. Patton argued today, do limit the applicability of the right to appointment of counsel to a person who is a child at the time of that appointment. And Mr. Hall is certainly not a child today. I don't think that's even a contested issue. Now, why would I say that it's significant that the court used the word child in the appointment statute, which is, I believe, 5110? Because the legislature went out of its way to not use the term child at other places in the code when they were speaking about a person who had advanced over that age of 18 that is the limit of a person being called a child.
But in order to rule your way on that, would we have to go against FIA?
I don't believe so. I don't think that contradicts FIA at all. Because, again, this is not FIA is a application for writ of habeas corpus case. This is a right to the appointment of counsel case, and this claim is properly brought as a civil claim in the Supreme Court of Texas. So Valle basically is a case that says the Court of Criminal Appeals doesn't have jurisdiction over that.
But for the principle that the law controls, whether it's a juvenile or criminal case, attaches at the time of the adjudication.
Correct.
And if you apply that logic, why wouldn't that same logic apply here in terms of if you're adjudicated before 18, then the law of the juvenile code is going to apply throughout?
Well, I don't have any problem with that at all. I do agree the law of the juvenile code is what's applicable here. And I think the language of the juvenile code is what I'm asking the court to pay particular attention
to. Okay, so that, all right. So if we go to the detention versus commitment argument.
Sure, yes, that was your question earlier.
Yeah, that it strikes me that, I mean, we don't do a lot of juvenile justice code construction here, and mm-hmm. it's not readily apparent to me that detention has a term of art attached to it.
Well, I think it is a term of art, and I'm asking this court to hold that it is. I understand Mr. Patton's argument. It is true that in some cases when a term is not defined specifically by a statute, that the courts will go to some sort of extratextual considerations to determine what the name of that or what the word means. Many times the courts say that we should apply the plain meaning of that word. But I think in this case, when you read the Juvenile Justice Code as a whole, the context of the use of the word detention is clear that its meaning is not and is a decidedly different thing than a post-adjudication commitment, which is really the situation that Mr. Hall is in. And it's distinguishable from a mere detention that he was detained, if you will, before his adjudication hearing and his determinate sentence was applied.
So you would say that if he was adjudicated at 13, he'd be entitled to, well, I know you're saying he's not entitled to counsel, but let's presume he is entitled to counsel.
Okay.
He would have the right to counsel for his during the time where he's being held before his adjudication. But once he's adjudicated, the right to counsel goes away for a habeas proceeding.
For a habeas proceeding, right. I think what counsel has directed the court's attention to, section, make sure I get this right, 5110A7, which provides that a child may be represented by an attorney at a habeas corpus proceeding challenging the legality of his detention. And so habeas corpus is certainly applicable. Okay, this is what he wants to do. He wants to file a writ of habeas corpus. There is the question on the table for this court to resolve is that habeas corpus application that he wants to pursue going to challenge the legality of his detention? And it's our position that that cannot be the case because if you look at section 51 or 5401, that's where you see the legislature discussing a detention hearing and using that term, detention, in a particular way to describe that period of time when a juvenile is held over pending a adjudication hearing and then subsequently a disposition hearing where he can be either released on probation or sent to the Texas Youth Commission, et cetera.
You said there were three reasons why there was no statutory right. One was, well, Hall isn't a child. And what were two and three?
Right. The three reasons why he doesn't have this statutory right are, number one, he's not a child. Number two, he's not challenging his detention in this case. And thirdly, I think counsel argued in a reply brief that our argument was on this issue was frivolous, but I completely disagree that it's frivolous, that he did not demonstrate to this trial court judge that he was in fact indigent. And I think that is an important consideration. The Juvenile Justice Code requires that anybody seeking the appointment of counsel be able to demonstrate that they don't have the resources to hire counsel on their own. And the motion that was filed by Mr. Hall in this case did not contain any information concerning his status as to whether or not he was able to afford counsel at this time.
Probably a pretty good guess, though, isn't it?
Well, I agree with you. Okay. It's probably a pretty good guess, but there's a reason why the legislature says the things they say, and one of the things they said is you have to prove that you're indigent. And so in this case, we have no idea of really knowing for sure whether Mr. Hall's circumstances have changed. I can tell you what has changed about Mr. Hall since he was first put through the juvenile system. And I apologize to the court, I'm going to wet my lips here because I'm doing a little chat. But what has changed for Mr. Hall, since he was involved in the juvenile system initially, is that he's aged up, okay? He is now an adult. And I know that Mr. Patton argues that it would be sort of an unconstitutional distinction to draw to say we're going to treat an adult offender differently than we're going to treat a child merely because they've aged up. But I don't think that is a problem at all, to tell you the truth. I don't think that it's unconstitutional. I think the Supreme Court of the United States has said that when you're going to consider an age discrimination type of claim, you're going to be applying a rational basis kind of test, and I think that...
Well, the court already does that. I mean, they don't let juvenile offenders be executed.
Exactly. That's another example of how we can treat juveniles or people who are younger than 18 years old differently than adults. There are rational reasons to treat adults differently than children. They're more mentally developed. They're more capable of making decisions for themselves than our youth. And so there are rational reasons to treat a person who's aged up differently than a person who's
young. Can the case be decided on that point alone?
I believe it can, because I think it is very clear that the legislature's appointment of counsel provision in the juvenile code is limited to a person who is a child.
Is that true if he can't be tried until before he reaches majority?
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Is that true if he cannot be tried before he reaches majority?
Yes, what happens is when a child cannot be tried before he reaches majority, it happens where in cases where a child is not apprehended, say, until after they've turned 18. In those cases, there's really two things that can happen. Number one, the juvenile court can not have jurisdiction at all because, again, he's not 18. Or they can assume jurisdiction to undertake a transfer of that case to adult court. And I think there are circumstances that are needed to be considered to determine whether or not a transfer to adult court is appropriate. But if the juvenile isn't brought into the juvenile court before he turns 18, then the juvenile court does not have jurisdiction to deal with that case as a juvenile case.
But if he's brought in but not tried before he reaches 18, he's just caught a few days before, then what happens on appointed counsel? How does it work?
Well, what happens on appointed counsel? Well, I can tell you that there is a code provision in the Juvenile Justice Code that provides for continuing jurisdiction once proceedings have begun. And in those cases, the code actually provides that the juvenile court continues to have jurisdiction over those proceedings.
So
but if he turns into an adult, I would argue he doesn't have the right to appointment of counsel, at least not a statutory right in the juvenile code. But he would certainly have a constitutional right. We know from Gideon versus Wainwright, I mean, that there is a constitutional right to the appointment of counsel. But the code, the juvenile code, would not be the place to look to find that adult offenders at that time their right to the appointment of counsel.
If your child argument is right,
right,
then it seems to me a consequence of that is if he's not tried until after he's an adult, even though it was for a crime allegedly committed when he was a minor, he would have no right under the statute for counsel, appointed counsel.
I think that's right. And I'll say that again, one of the things that would happen to a person like that is that they would need to be, the juvenile court would not be able to have a adjudication hearing, a standard juvenile adjudication hearing over that adult person. The only thing that they would have jurisdiction to do is to certify and transfer that person, if the appropriate circumstances applied, to a adult criminal district court where they could be tried as an adult for that offense. And in those circumstances, he would certainly be entitled to counsel appointed under the Code of Criminal Procedure. And so another thing that I'd like to point out is, with regard to the detention question, is that Justice Brisker pointed out that, you know, opening up this avenue of having appointed counsel upon request to juvenile offenders might bring about an abuse of the system, because you might have all types of juveniles claiming that they have a right to the appointment of counsel. And I think that is a serious question that this court should grapple with in determining whether or not you're going to interpret the term detention to mean something more than what I contend that it means, which is just that pre-adjudication holdover awaiting for the court to take action. One of the things that the government code provides, section 311.023, section 5, that you can consider in determining what construction you're going to give to a term in a statute is the consequences of that construction. And I think that's so it's appropriate for this court to consider that the consequences of that construction would be that that people who were juveniles when they committed their crimes, that they are entitled to the appointment of counsel in a situation, a habeas situation, where adult criminals are not under either the state, the Texas Constitution or the federal Constitution. So for all of these reasons, unless there's any other further questions that the court has of me at this time, I know I'm just about out of time, I would like to ask that you find that Hall is not a child, that he is not challenging a mere detention, that he did not establish his indigence to the trial court, and as a result that you will deny the request for mandamus relief. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Patton, I'm not a habeas expert. what does one have to prove to be entitled to habeas relief?
That's actually the first topic I was going to talk about, because the answer to that question is, in a habeas proceeding arising from a juvenile delinquency proceeding, nobody knows the answer.
Well, let's say you're an adult, you commit a crime, you go to jail, 5 years later you file a habeas. What are the elements?
What you do is you go to the Court of Criminal Appeals website, which has a 13 or 14 page form, which is mandatory to use and has instructions on how to fill out the form and where to file the form, and you file it in the district court.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, does it challenge the underlying conviction?
It challenges the underlying conviction as void.
Okay.
And it can be, the most common ground is ineffective assistance of counsel.
But it would have to be filed here.
No.
If it's a habeas from a juvenile proceeding?
Habeas from a juvenile proceeding would fall within the exclusive jurisdiction of the juvenile court. And then
is it civil?
Makes it a civil, and then it would be, if habeas relief was denied, it would be appealed to the Court of Appeals. Which brings up the interesting point that under the state's construction, Mr. Hall does not get appointed trial counsel, but the statute provides for appointed appellate counsel. So he would get appointed appellate counsel for the appeal of his post-adjudication habeas.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you can raise ineffective assistance in an appeal. What's different about raising it in a habeas proceeding, I think in this case 7 years later?
Because in a habeas proceeding, you can go outside the record. You can bring in new evidence to show that the conviction's void. And that's a primary difference. Again, I am not a habeas lawyer, but as I understand,
but the main thing is that it's attacking the underlying conviction.
Yes.
And if it's attacking the underlying conviction, then the law that applies to the underlying conviction would carry forward. I mean, that's the argument you're making. It's not like you're claiming habeas because of something that's happened to you in jail or something new that's arisen.
No.
The subject matter of the habeas are the proceedings that happen in the juvenile court.
Well, you can actually have a habeas proceeding that involves post-conviction, although Mr. Hall's not conviction. Matter, you have a change in the law. So you can have matters that arise after an adjudication, after a conviction, that can form part of a habeas.
But all of them go to attacking the underlying conviction.
Yes. And, again, you go to the Court of Criminal Appeals website, and they have forms. They give you cites to the Rules of Appellate Procedure. I think there's a 67-section statute governing habeas for adults. None of this is around for somebody attacking a juvenile delinquency adjudication. We've never heard an articulated basis of why the state would basically make somebody who was adjudicated while they were a child have to fend for themselves pro se at a trial court level on an area that would be baffling to an experienced attorney, and then they get an appellate attorney to appeal that. It doesn't make any sense. And one final point, I think, if it needs addressing, is whether he's an indigent or not. Mr. Hall's a smart guy. He's a really, really smart guy. And in his petition to the Court of Appeals, he said, in the alternative, appointing me a counsel, send it back to the trial court to have the trial court specify the rulings, the reason, basically findings of fact, conclusions of law, why I was denied counsel. I think if there's a problem with indigency, which I don't think there is, the solution is to send it back, is not to deny him counsel. If there are no other questions, I'd simply ask for the court to grant Mr. Hall's request.
If we send it back and it determines that he's indeed indigent, well, we'll just have Levitt right here again, won't we?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I haven't given it much attention in the brief, because then we start all over.
Thank you. Mr. Patton, the clause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.